Are you ready to become a better version of yourself, to become a leader in your personal and professional life? Then welcome to the CJ Evolution Podcast, where we put a twist on traditional criminal justice professions and provide you with the tools you need to set yourself up for success in your career and for the future. Now, welcome your host, the CJ Evolutionist himself, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Episode 259 of CJ Evolution, the first episode of 2019. Thank you so much for tuning in to this great and growing show, growing because of you, the listener and supporter. If you would take a moment, rate and review the podcast on iTunes, I sure would appreciate it. Again, that's how we continue to grow, by you tuning in, sharing it with family and friends, and reviews. Thank you so much. Special thanks to all those first responders out there. Whatever you're doing in the criminal justice field, keep on doing it. I hope you have a fantastic new year. I hope you get promoted. I hope you get that extra duty assignment, whatever you're going for in your career in 2019. I hope you get it. It's going to be a great year. You got to have that positive attitude. Go for your dreams. Special thanks to Four Sigmatic, my partner in this podcast. They produce great and wonderful products, most notably their mushroom coffee, Lion's Mane. I love it. I drink it every day. If you head over to cjevolution.com, you're going to see a link to Four Sigmatic. And best of all, you're going to get 15% off all your purchases using the promo code CJEVO. Enjoy. You know, folks, my next guest, Morgan Wright, has been on the show last year. This guy's amazing. He's an internationally recognized expert on cybersecurity, strategy, cyber terrorism, identity theft, and privacy. He's all over the major news networks talking about security and cybersecurity issues. His landmark testimony before Congress on healthcare.gov changed how the government collected personal identifiable information. In this episode, we talk about a variety of topics, how law enforcement is changing, some of the challenges law enforcement will face in the future from our perspective. And again, I hope you enjoy this episode. Got a ton of great guests coming on. Morgan Wright is the man. You're going to love this episode. So take some notes. Enjoy. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Morgan Wright is in the house again. He was on the show July 2017, and he's back on. Morgan, you here?
Where? Here? Yes.
How's it going,
it's
buddy?
It's a new year. I'm not sure exactly where I'm at.
Yeah. It's benefit of technology, right?
Yes.
How you doing,
I can be
sir?
Anywhere.
You doing good?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, this is we'll see what 2019 brings. It was a little strange with 2018. I had some unique business challenges and some new things I'm working on. But, yeah, I think we've got it all figured out, and 2019 should be the year of the cat. Me and Al Stewart, we're going to play that song.
Well, I mean, for those of listeners out there, Morgan, who don't know who you are, can you give a little bit to the listeners of who Morgan Wright is?
Yeah, well, hey, most importantly, since it's the CJ, you know, Evolution Podcast, I started off life out of college as a city police officer. Yeah, I was a little rookie. I was on the Salina Police Department for 2.5 years. Then me and about 2,500, 3,000 people applied for the state patrol, and I was a lucky one. I was one of the 16 picked to go to the academy, so I've really loved being a trooper, but I wanted to get into investigations. And of course, Kansas is a state patrol, not a state police. So I went to the Garden City Police Department, worked myself into investigations. So I had about 18 years in doing that. And then I wanted to play on a bigger stage. So I started doing my own thing. I was actually used to teach computer crime investigation. So I got lucky. I had a couple clients like Microsoft and Lucasfilms and PepsiCo, did a lot of work for those guys. And then I spent a year training the FBI when they were getting into internet investigations. This is, you know, the very late 90s, 98, 99. And then moved out here to Virginia and did a lot of work in the justice intelligence community from the defense side, but had the chance to do some stuff with the State Department overseas. And then doing a lot of stuff in technology with Cisco and Alcatel-Lucent Bell Labs. And then my last kind of official role, I was the 2012 senior law enforcement advisor for the Republican National Convention. And then, yeah, so I mean, it's kind of, I mean, that's, I hate to say that, but, you know, I've been, but then for the last 15 years, I've been the chief technology analyst for Fox News and Fox Business, a senior fellow at the Center for Digital Government. And now this last year I took on, I'm now a national contributor on cybersecurity and national security for thehill.com.
Well, thank you for your service, sir. And now, as far as technology, Morgan, really quick. I mean, did you always like? I mean, obviously, this is your knack. From a very young age, did you have a technology bug or what?
Oh, hell no, dude. When I see, you got to remember, I'm like 58. So when I was growing up, the only technology was the phone and how long the cord on the phone could reach.
Me, you and me both.
Yeah. So no, I never really got into, but I will tell you, my senior year of high school, I started doing some programming, and these were these little small computers with the cards. You'd fill out the cards and you could actually program a computer to do stuff. But I never really messed with that until actually I was on the state patrol and got my first computer, a Tandy 1000 SL. And then me and a couple friends were doing a lot of accident reconstruction, which is mathematically intensive, a lot of engineering formulas, things to calculate. And basically, it was out of laziness. Started writing some programs in BASIC. And then that led to then when I became a detective, it's kind of like, hey, let's do some stuff with computer crime. So I went to the very first computer crime class in Kansas back in 93. Mm-hmm. Ended up instructing for an organization that we taught federal, state, and local law enforcement and international folks. Did a two-week basically boot camp every year. And then from there, just kind of I got into the other elements of it, which was the security piece of it. So starting off in 2000, did a lot of work on the what was then called information security side with defense agencies and then big banks, because big banks mm-hmm. were paying lots of money because the internet was becoming big. You know, things were being connected. And yeah, that's just kind of went from there. And then from there, it blossomed into a lot of the work I did at Cisco, ran global operations on public safety, homeland security. We built lots and lots of secure networks. And then the piece de resistance, as the French would say, we helped when I was at Alcatel-Lucent, we built and deployed the first equipment for what you guys now call FirstNet. My team, and I was the leading the team, we built the first equipment and did the first demonstration and actually deployed the very first operational public safety broadband network in the United States. We made history. Yeah, so and that's part of what we did at the 2012 Republican National Convention is we had the first operational use of public safety broadband in the United States at the RNC.
Jeez, my God.
So just kind of, you know, you go from one that you when you kind of get in, it's kind of fun because you start going – the advantage to it, even from a cop standpoint, is cops are good about figuring, you know, you know, it's like the Marines, you know, we'll make do with what we got. Good. You know, we don't have enough stuff. Good. We'll just have to figure it out.
Sure.
So, but started realizing is that a lot of the people understood technology, but they didn't understand the problems. And a lot of people understood the problems, but they had no clue what technology could do. So those people that were in between the two that said, hey, look, I can go 2 to 3 questions deep on the technology. And I know intuitively, and I know from talking to the engineers what it can do and what it can't do. But hey, let's try a couple, you know, we can always be creative. But then on the mission side, I said, look, I understand the mission. I know what you're trying to accomplish, what needs to be done. So you kind of become that interpreter in between the two that says, hey, here's what the tech guys need to know. Here's what the operational people need to know. And that's how we used to build solutions.
Yeah, it just amazes me. We were talking a little bit off the air. It amazes me how far we have come from a law enforcement perspective. I remember I've been doing this 23 years now, and I remember it still baffles me, Morgan, how much. And again, I know we're always kind of behind, at least, you know, a lot of agencies. But it amazes me. Now we got laptops and we have all this technology at our disposal. I mean, it makes me wonder what's next for law enforcement and technology. You hit on a little bit of it, but what do you think is coming as far as technology for LE?
Well, let me tell you something that's very interesting that's coming out, and it's along the technology side, but it is one of these unique combinations of both technology and just plain old-fashioned police work, and that is long-range familial DNA test or DNA matching. And that was used to catch the Golden State Killer. That was used in a case, April Tinsley. This is a case actually I worked on with America's Most Wanted. I actually helped build some tech for America's Most Wanted that we deployed on the 1,000th episode. But what was interesting about this is I think you're going to see – and here's what happens is that the way they caught the Golden State Killer is that a couple of detectives out there, they started going, hey, look, you know, there's so much DNA out there now, and there's one called GED match. It's an open source DNA database. You can submit your DNA there and find out if you have other family members, find out matches. It's kind of like taking the 23andMe and the Ancestry and all these other commercial kits, but really putting a lot more detail behind it. Mm-hmm. So they started thinking, here's the deal though, too. Patrick, you know, as you know, too, is that you can collect DNA from a crime scene, but unless they're in CODIS, unless they're in, you know, some database, mm-hmm. there's no match. It just sits there and you wait and you wait and wait for something to be there. Well, somebody started saying, well, look, from that, though, we could probably figure out at least some family trees and stuff like that. So what you're able to do now, they took this DNA from the Golden State Killer And they were actually able to go back and start tracing family trees and start branching out and start narrowing it down to where they said, well, we've narrowed it down to basically this family. And then this is where the good old fashioned police work comes in. You start pulling social media postings. You start looking at newspaper. You start looking at records. So you still have to take this and kind of make that little leap from it's kind of like jumping across a chasm a little bit. Well, we're here, but we don't have any DNA to connect us here. But we've narrowed it down. It's like this huge funnel. We've narrowed it down now to a handful of people. Mm-hmm. So now you have to do the plain old fashioned police work. Well, what happened with April Tinsley? She was kidnapped out of Fort Wayne, Indiana. Her body was found 3 days later. She's 8 years old, found in the ditch. She'd been killed. She'd been raped. And there was DNA there. And then what made it terrible was this sick POS then came back later and left condoms in these kids' baskets with notes that says, hey, I killed April Tinsley. Your next, scrawled notes on these barn doors and basically taunted the police and the family. Well, they did this same thing, too, familial matching. So they went back and they were able to go back four generations. And they said, well, here's the DNA we have from the scene. It's these four generations here. And then they started narrowing it down, narrowing it down. They got it down to where it had to be one of two brothers. Well, one of the brothers is all over social media, but the other brother they never talked about. And so it kind of looked like he was the black sheep of the family. Mm-hmm. So they staked out his place, got, you know, the things cops do. We stake out, wait till it gets into the trash, took the coffee cup or the other stuff, took the DNA, and guess what? It's a match to the crime scene, and this guy pled guilty to the crime, and this had gone uncaught. So I think – and there's another neat thing, too, and it's called DNA phenotyping. And so you could take some DNA from the scene and through a process – and actually it's done by a company just 10 miles from where I live up here in Northern Virginia. It's Parabon. And they can actually take the DNA now and from that extract out what you ought to look like. So now you can start getting a facial, but basically it's like it's better than a police sketch artist, but not quite, you know, an actual picture. But you get that human looking face, and they are so darn accurate with this stuff. So, I mean, you've got the cool stuff going on like that with DNA. And we haven't even begun to scratch the surface of this familial matching and DNA phenotyping. But then on the other hand, you've got things that are going to be more applicable to, say, cops on the street, things like artificial intelligence and machine learning and how maybe we can apply that to drones and all these other neat things. Cops want toys. Well, I want smart toys now, too. So how can we start combining this together?
Well, and I like what you said, Morgan, about how it's always going to come down, or it sounds like it's going to come down to good old-fashioned police work. Now, no matter how much technology we have, we always have to come down to, okay, we need to talk to somebody. We need to do some knock and talks. We need to really do some good old-fashioned police work.
I went through a school I was put on for serial criminal profiling or serial crime profiling. It was taught by members of the FBI's original behavioral science unit. But they had a phrase on there that says, no matter how much we can tell you about, you know, it's an adequate a disorganized, inadequate offender, an adequate organized offender, you can give all this stuff, but it still comes down to what he called Goya Cod, G-O-Y-A-K-O-D. Get off your ass, knock on doors.
I like that.
And I have it written in this book right here. It's called, it was the Advanced Homicide and Serial Crime Investigators course. But that's really what it boils down to, is you cannot, I think one of the dangers is you want to sit back and think you can press a button and some robot's going to come in and do your crime scene for you and then pop out at the end and says, here's your suspect, go arrest them. It's never going to be that way. It's going to be more helpful about getting better at identifying potentially who, narrowing down the suspects, getting you to that lead or that next potential lead much faster than in our day. I remember one of the homicides we worked, we actually had the doctor, Robin Cotton from Cellmark Diagnostics, who did the OJ case.
Oh, wow.
Came out and testified in one of our homicide cases. But in those days, you needed DNA the size of a football field. You needed that big of a sample to do this. And it took a long time. Well, now we're getting to the point where DNA results can come from smaller samples. They're quicker. It's faster. Same thing with fingerprints.
I was going to say, same thing with fingerprints.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know what? It still doesn't mean that the machine can't tell you the person did it. It's still getting a detective with the case file sitting across from this person and conducting a good, thorough forensic interview or some kind of interview and interrogation, you know, behavioral analysis interview. Mm-hmm. It's still going to take skills to be able to connect all this evidence that's been brought to you now by the wonders of science. But you still got to be a good cop. All it's going to do is make you more effective. but it cannot substitute for being a detective, for being a cop.
Now, do you, I mean, you still talk to a lot of law enforcement agencies, do a lot of work with them. Do you think, and I hate to beat up on millennials here, but
I mean, do
you think that that might be a problem, not for all millennials, but some of them? Maybe it's a problem for veteran officers, too, who are so used to technology, are so used to just pushing a button. You know what I mean? I mean, it's kind of like they're so technology reliant that they're reluctant to get out there and talk to people. And I guess that's a supervisor issue that, you know, the supervisors have to issue or have to work on. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Can you imagine though saying, hey, you need to go interview the neighbors? Well, is there an app for that?
I bet you some of the cops would ask that.
But I'll tell you the challenges though, too, is you have a group of people, and whether it's millennials or whoever comes after millennials, think about it this way. We have lost the skills of communication. Mm-hmm. When you've spent the majority of your time texting and not interfacing with people, for example, I'll give you an example. By the way, what period of time? I'm going to give you two time periods, and you tell me which was more dangerous for kids 13 to 18. Was it 1960 or 2015?
Well, 60 we had.
What was the highest homicide rate for kids 13 to 18? Was it 1960 or 2015?
I'm going to say 2015.
Negative. It was 1960.
Huh. Vietnam War and stuff like that?
Well, no, it's actually a lot of this goes back to social media. So there are fewer and fewer children. In fact, homicide used to be the second leading cause of death for boys age 13 to 18. Accidents were first for all age groups. But it's suicide now is the second leading cause. Homicides dropped down to third. Well, homicide rates have gone down for everybody. Why? Because as the advent of social media has risen from 2007 when the iPhone came out, Facebook went public, and you have all these apps now. As you watch from 2010 forward, as these networks taken off, the homicide rate has dropped. Why? Because fewer kids are going out. They're taking longer to get their driver's license, so they're not as mobile anymore. So, and that's why for boys, there's been a marked decline in the homicide rate because fewer of them are actually out in the public where you actually kind of need to be for some of these homicides to happen. So the reason I tie that all together is that you see the increase of social media, see the increase of tech like, you know, the smartphones and stuff, the gaming that's keeping more people inside. There's fewer and fewer reasons to have to talk to somebody IRL, you know, in real life, to actually interface with people. And I see that translating over to now that you've got officers on the street, where have they ever had to have deconfliction and actually talk somebody out of something or be in a very stressful situation where there was no safe space available and you had to negotiate or talk, you know, or talk somebody down or reason with them and use your powers of persuasion? I think that artifact comes, I think, from the technology piece. And I think that's the toughest thing to get over. How do you give somebody communication skills that has spent the last 4 to 5 years doing almost everything, playing games online or texting?
Now, where do you think it's going, Morgan? I mean, I guess, you know, I mean, obviously technology is very important. I don't think we could do our jobs that effectively without it. But there's got to be a balance, right? I mean, there's got to be a line right there. I agree with you 150%. I think we need to teach our young officers and, you know, and maybe older officers too. They need to get their butts out there, get out of the car and talk to people that everything can't be settled with a few clicks of a mouse.
Well, you know, and that gets back to the old, I don't want to drag out. I mean, a lot of people have given negative connotation to community policing, but I believe in it from the standpoint is it's really about the relationship you have with your community. You got to get out of your car. You cannot drive around in the car all the time with the windows up and never interface with your community. Get out, talk with them, find out. I develop more CIs and, you know, whatever you want to call them, snitches and sources of information simply because I'd get out and I'd go talk to the motel clerk at 2 o'clock in the morning, mostly because I was bored. But second of all, is you never know what they knew, you know, and I'd get calls. And I think a lot of people have missed the art of conversation. And that's one of the reasons why I loved being a detective was it allowed me to I solved more cases through interview and interrogation than I did through physical evidence, because it's how do you get somebody to talk to you and tell you things that they know intuitively that the minute they tell you that and you record it, it's going to be used against them, which you've already told them, you know, most of the time, and they're going to go to prison sometimes for the rest of their life. And I think, you know, to me, you can create all the technology you want to say, well, that person's lying, or, you know, machines are not infallible. Nothing is ever 100%. And I still go back to what are the skills we're learning? I don't think we're learning them in school. I don't think or enough of them. And like you say, even the older officers, well, that's the way we've always done it. Well, dude, if I would used to be a state trooper. If we did the way things that they always did, we would have been wearing wool uniforms during the middle of summer.
Yeah.
Well, you know, no, things change and they have to change for a reason. But I tell you, to get to the answer, I don't know what the answer is, yeah, other than I think that you're going to still get a group of people who want to be in police work. But I think that number is dwindling. As you probably have seen, too, it gets harder and harder to recruit. Some people are talking, you know, remember before it was kind of like if you had tattoos up and down your arms, there's like, there's no way you're getting a job.
Yeah.
Now it's kind of like, well, we're making exceptions. You know, some people are, or I know the FBI as a matter of fact, it used to be is that like with DEA, no drug use. If you had any drug use, you were disqualified. Then it was like, well, it was if you only smoked marijuana within the last 10 years, then it was like 5 years.
Because the polls get smaller. Like,
yeah, some places almost getting down to, well, look, just tell us you haven't smoked dope in the last 30 minutes, you know, we're going to put your application for it.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, times have changed. It's so much. And again, I mean, there are limits to that, but yeah, it's just crazy. And to your point, Morgan, we are seeing dwindling
yep,
recruitment efforts. And I don't, you know, it could be a variety of things. I think some of it or a big chunk of it is the negative publicity, yep, that the media generally showers on, police, you know, the Ferguson effect, all that stuff.
That is absolutely, I think you're spot on. I got good friends out here in the National Capital Region from the Arlington County Police Department to Prince William, Alexandria. I mean, agencies that are good size, you know, they're 300 to 400 officers, but we're in an area where there's 80 to 100 agencies, mm-hmm, you know, 10 million people in this region out here between the different areas and, you know, lots and lots and lots of cops and everybody's recruiting and they're recruiting against. I mean, it's one thing when you're the next closest town or that's the size is maybe 50 to 100 miles away. You've got agencies out here that border each other that everybody's trying to recruit the same qualified recruit. Mm-hmm. And you got 5 to 10 agencies all within driving distance for any of those recruits or potential recruits to apply to. So I tell you, I don't know what it's going to be is we're going to have to start thinking about. Here's the reality. So, yeah, sometimes you just have to face the brutal facts, which is, if you're staffed, let's say for, pick a round number, 100 officers, and that's what your authorized strength is, and that's what you figured out, that's how we can respond to calls for service, and here's what we can do. Well, let's say that the most you can ever get anymore going forward is 80. That's it. You never get above 80. So do you whine and moan and say, well, we're going to design our department for 100 people, or do you face a brutal fact and say, look, mm-hmm, we're going to have to start changing what we respond to. We're going to have to start changing what we prioritize. We're going to have to start changing our patrol staffing and stuff to reflect the realities, which is now we have, instead of, you know, 1 to 1,000, which is the traditional, maybe it's 1 to 1,500. Mm-hmm. And we just can't cover the same thing. I used to tell them, look, I have a duty to a community or the state, not to one individual. I don't have a specific duty to you. My duty is to the state of Kansas, yeah, at that time, you know, or the city of Garden City. And so, and I think for people, the expectation is it's personal service. It's like, well, I called you. You're supposed to show up. Well, you know what? Maybe we get down to the point to where you've got strictly civilians. And I've seen this in places to where you've got strictly civilians doing phone calls or handling, yeah, all property related crimes.
Yeah.
Nothing. You got a stolen car, you ain't going to see a cop. You got somebody broke into your automobile, you ain't going to see a cop. You know, you'll see a civilian. But, you know, we're changing what you respond to.
Well, and that you hit it, and that's where the importance of technology and data, analyzing the data to allocate those resources effectively. I'm with you 100%. We can't keep going on the same path, at least most agencies. We have to look at that resource allocation. We have to, okay, what do we need to be responding to this? We had for instance, we go thousands of alarms a year, you know, and I know it's simplistic, but it proves the point. I mean, 90% of them are false alarms. So what
and
are
a
you
lot
gonna,
of people
you're going to keep going
you put in
to those?
The false alarm statutes? I mean, you put in the you put in the ordinances for false alarm,
yeah,
or you work.
But
here's the problem. Here's what I say to you, Patrick. It's not up to law enforcement to solve an industry problem.
Oh,
and
no,
that's going to sound harsh to some people, but it's like, no, you guys need to solve the problem, because here's what happens. And I would phrase it, maybe people wouldn't like it, but to say, look, if you keep having false alarms, sure, we can keep finding you, but you still want us to show up. No. After, let's say, 3 false alarms and you haven't solved the problem, or you haven't trained the people, you know, or you pay the fines, or maybe it's 3 or 5, whatever the case is, it's like, we're not going to respond anymore. And I'll tell you why. Because we know from statistics, and these are national statistics too, is the more you respond to an alarm that ends up being a false alarm, the more lack the more personal safety we'll lack. People, I was guilty of this too. It's oh man, here we go again. It's the same alarm.
Yeah, and your officer safety goes down maybe, and your
officer safety situation awareness goes down, and it's kind of like, no, we can't afford to do that. In other words, it's like if you drove around with your lights on your car on all the time, people would get desensitized to it and they wouldn't pull over. They say, here comes, you know, the guys driving around with his
good
lights,
analogy.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but when I was a state trooper, we were really – and the way they trained us, too, is even when we did car stops, I had a big – one of these old big Aerodyne light bars. But the only thing we used was the outside red spots. We had two red spotlights up there, and then we had a handheld spotlight. But we would just turn our spots on. But the only time they wanted us really using all lights is really like when we're doing an emergency run, we're on the scene of an accident. In other words, when those lights were on, we kind of wanted to train the public to know this really means something. You know, and I think that's what we're going to get down to is that when you start having something, when the police show up, it really means something. But, hey, look, if it's not a crime in progress and nobody's life is being threatened, you may have to get down to the point of, like, say, confronting the brutal facts. Is like somebody's breaking in. Think about this. Somebody's breaking into a store at 3 o'clock in the morning. Okay. Is the store – I mean, it's a store. It's nobody's in the store. It's an empty store, and they're stealing property. It's like – I mean – yeah. I know people are going to say, yeah, hey, let's respond to that. But I'm saying it's in the future.
Crime.
If you're down 25%, can you afford to respond to that property crime to where you've got at the expense of not being out there to stop in a high crime area, a potential robbery, or a sexual assault or, I don't know. These are philosophical questions. Technology will help us do a better job of deciding when and where we need to place our officers, intelligence-led policing, the predictive stuff. But it's going to come down to some philosophical questions to say, what is the threshold now before we send an officer? If it's just simply somebody simply breaking into a car, guess what? Maybe we don't respond anymore to those.
Yeah. Well, and I agree with you. And I think part of that, the big component to that, Morgan, is the political component. Because now I think most law enforcement executives would agree with you, but now it's selling it to the powers that be. You know what I mean? And selling it to that city council or that city administrator because, there's other people involved in that, up the flagpole.
It reminds me of a story. One of the former presidents of the IACP, Craig Steckler, I think his name was. Yeah. And he talked about how in his department, accidents went down by 95%. They go, how'd you do that? He said, we quit responding to them.
Everybody's like they got their pen and paper out, waiting to take down some wise words of wisdom.
Yeah. And that's what I thought. What'd you guys do? What kind of program? No, we just quit responding.
Was that an app?
If it was a property damage only accident, no police response. They'll take care of it with the insurance company.
Yeah.
And accidents went down in his community by 95%.
Jeez. Now, shifting gears a little bit, you're a cyber terrorism expert, ID expert, privacy expert, technology expert. What do you think, Morgan? And maybe this is too broad of a question, but I'll ask it anyway. You see threats all the time. You're working in the industry. What do you think some of the biggest technological threats that we face are?
Actually, there's a couple things. Let me throw something out at you. Revenge porn using AI. And now think about where this could go.
Wow.
And actually, it's happening right now. We're getting so sophisticated with artificial intelligence is that you can now graft and project motion of some I could take your face and put it on somebody else's body, and it would almost be impossible because it's generated by AI. It would be almost impossible to prove that was a fake.
Oh my God!
Oh, there's a couple articles happening right now. Same thing with images. So this gets into issues of can you really trust what you see anymore. So, I mean, there's some interesting issues there. I think we're going to see I don't make predictions. Everybody says, what are your predictions for 2019? I said, I don't know, the same stupid stuff we did in 2018. People are going to click on links. They're going to have bad passwords. I mean, don't give me the predictions.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are, nobody ever gets those things right.
Yeah,
But I will tell you is that the things that you had chiefs of police at one time that didn't even know what email was and they couldn't run email. They'd have people print it out. I think you're going to see a generation of leadership that's going to have to change. Like I saw with the military to where you have generals who understood the importance of network switches and routers and could say, I need a network that does this. Now they wouldn't get it in programming, but they would understand what routing and switching did. And they would say, here's what I need my network to do for me. I mean, they were that technically proficient. I think we're going to see a lot of transitions to the cloud, mm-hmm. away from departments and other people trying to maintain their own servers and their own infrastructure. Because A, it's too costly. B, it's tough to get people with the skills that you need. And look, see, you can't. I don't care how big and bad you think your department are, even the New York City PD and New York City Department of Information Technology, NYDOIT. I don't care how good these people think. Mm-hmm. You have nation states out there like Iran, like Russia, like North Korea, like China, Syria, all these other places that are targeting. How many agencies have been hit by ransomware? Way too many.
Yeah.
You know, how many people? Atlanta, for example. Here's Atlanta, NFL city. 10 years of in-car video wiped out, records wiped out. All right, so I think we're going to see a transition away from that to the cloud. I think you are going to see the more deliberate application of technologies, especially from an artificial intelligence standpoint, everything that will translate recordings and turn them into reports to being able to analyze data and do help you do a better job of resource allocation. Mm-hmm. Not so much as well for the predictive policing, but let's say that you've got a town that normally you've got 10 officers out for a shift, let's say, and everybody thinks, well, you divide that area, you divide the city into 10, you know, equal areas, and there's an officer there. No, you may have 35 to 40% of the city that doesn't even see a cop. You know why? Because there's no crime there.
Exactly.
I need to put cops on dots, you know, where the crime's actually happening. If there's nothing happening in your neighborhood, and I can show that through statistics and AI helps me predict crime patterns and what's going on, you may find the concentration. There may be five cops in a five block area because guess where? That's where it's going down.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's working. It's working smarter, not harder.
Yeah.
And using technology to our advantage. And I think at least in my agency, Morgan, I can't speak for other agencies, obviously, but I think we're getting better at that. Looking at the data, saying, all right, okay, we're not going to devote resources over here. We're going to put our resources over here because that's where the crime is. That's where the issues are.
I'm an old farm boy, you know, from Kansas, and we used to have a little saying, man, if you're going to go fishing, go where the fish are.
Exactly.
Why would you want to fish a dry hole? So, you know, and as a cop, too, one of the things you want is I don't want to be bored to death. At least I didn't want to be. I wanted to be always involved. That was the great thing about being a trooper is I can kind of go out and create my own havoc, you know, create my own fun. Mm-hmm. But with the city sometimes some of these folks are responding call to call. But you know, I don't think too many cops just want to sit there and be bored. I think most of them want to say, "Hey, I want to be able to do. Show me what's going on, and you know, let me get involved. Let me start making traffic stops or talking to people, doing Terry stops, whatever it is. Let me start being proactive." You don't want to feel like a report taker either. I mean, mm-hmm. Give me some tools to where I can actually feel like I'm making a difference.
Yeah, yeah. Now maybe this is a dumb question, but I'll ask it anyway. Did you ever think, I always think, Morgan, I don't know if you did, but I always think as a young cop or a young man, did you ever think we would be at a point right now with technology that we are right now? I mean, did you ever think, oh my God, artificial intelligence? I mean, like we were talking off the air, you say AI and I think of like Terminator and shit like that. I never thought we would be living in an age where we're actually using that.
I'll tell you, I was just happy as a trooper when I got my first handheld radio. I thought, oh, man, this is state of the art. And here, it was an 800 megahertz radio that required a converter and repeater in the trunk because we had low-band radios at the time. No, I mean, you started thinking. Here's the danger, though. I think there's some people who can see the change, and there are some people who refuse to embrace it. And I'll give you a perfect example, and I'm not going to – it's not that I'm picking on the company. I got friends who still work there, but it's Panasonic and Panasonic Toughbook. Mm-hmm. I kind of look at that and I go, have we not moved past to where you've just got a rugged notebook sitting in the car and that's all it is? It's just basically a rugged terminal. I said, you start thinking about there is more computing power in the palm of your hand than there is in that Toughbook.
Exactly.
You know, and you start thinking, what are the different things I can do with that? What are the new applications? What's the type of information that I can get now? I don't want to have to lug. Nobody wants to lug a 15-pound notebook around that can withstand a drop from space and two atomic blasts. You know, that just you start going. And the other thing, too, is the Army's proved is do you really need all that ruggedization? They showed it with the iPod touches is that they would survive long enough and good enough even out in the field because you put artillery tables on there, sniper tables on there. Those things would last. It was cheaper to stack an extra 15 of them and just replace it when one got broke than it was to spend $5 million trying to ruggedize them.
Yeah, yeah. It's just.
So I think we are going to go through a phase to where you've still got the holdouts, the people who are senior to you, the ones that have been around for a while. They say, well, this is the way we've always done it. Yeah, well, this, you know, good thing the wheel was invented millions of years ago. Otherwise, we might be still driving around on horses, you know. But you know, you've got that group. Then you've got the folks like you who say, look, I'm not a millennial. I don't live my life like that, but I get the technology. Yeah. I understand the value of social media. And then you've got the people who are digital natives. This is the way they've grown up.
Yeah.
And so I think once your generation gets into that, all those senior leadership levels, I think you'll see policy start changing and the application of this technology. And look, we may have to fundamentally rethink. The Army does this, and the military, I should say, does this on a regular basis. How do we restructure our forces? It's like the Navy. It's not having a bunch of big ships anymore. It's about having these littoral battleships and having smaller vessels that are faster. Now, you still got your aircraft carriers, but maybe policing needs to go through that renaissance to say, maybe it's not about having, you know, 100 cars out on the street. Maybe it's something different. Maybe it's like with the UAVs, you know, and they fly missions with the Reapers and the all of these other big high-tech things. Maybe some of this stuff is people flying drones to certain areas and recording information, and then those drones, you know, are streaming back the video. I mean, how many times does an officer really need to be on the scene versus when can you get by with some maybe drones or something we haven't totally explored yet? But you think about the value of New York City was going to use those for New Year's Eve, but the rain, I think, kind of tamped that down. But, you know, when I was growing up, I don't think we could see far enough ahead because, you know, we hadn't had enough technology. Mm-hmm. Our idea of technology was green screen AS400. Yeah. Oh, this is really great stuff. and then we got our first, you know, Gateway P75, the first Pentium computer, and it had Windows for Workgroups 3.1.1 on there. And we could actually share files. Yeah. It's like, oh, this is cool. So I don't know. I don't think it's moving so fast now. I think that the issue is not that we can't imagine it. I think there's so much stuff we can imagine out there. Now the question is, what's really applicable to the mission? What's really applicable to what we do? And here's the bigger point. Where is there money available to do what we need to do?
I was going
to
say, with shrinking budgets, everybody's fighting. You know, budgets are, at least from the agencies, that I'm familiar with, budgets are shrinking. There's not a lot out there anymore. And so we need to come up with, like you said, Morgan, innovative ways to use technology to our advantage to, like you said, maybe it should come down. Maybe it'll come down. And I think it will in the future. We don't need an officer to be on that scene. You know, we can do it with a drone, you know, because technology, like you said, changes so quickly. God knows what it's going to be out there in 5 years, a year, 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, you think about traffic control. Or I was just thinking real quick. I mean, it may be just a minor injury, or it might be not an injury accident, but a minor accident. Somebody says, I've just had an accident here. And here's what I think. I think you're going to have all these cell towers that are around that maybe they become drone farms. Mm-hmm. And you fly a drone out of there.
Yeah.
And what it does, it flies over the area, takes pictures of everything, automatically maps it out for you. It knows the scale. It knows everything. And it sends it back. It sends a message down to the people down there. It says, hey, guess what? Your accident's been worked. You're free to go now. You know, it can read the license plate. All of this stuff is done automatically with the drone. And you don't need to send an officer out there. This thing's done, like, say, in 2 minutes. Hey, watch the commercial on TV. I know they were joking about it. It's either Geico or somebody else. They say, well, you know, hey, something's happened to our house. The storm's come through. Well, they're flying drones over all of these places now and doing damage assessment. Yeah. They're not sending adjusters out into the field anymore. They're flying drones.
Yeah, it's just amazing, the technology. It makes me funny. Maybe it's a bad example, but every time I go buy a piece of equipment, unless it's really, really expensive, they always ask me, or they probably ask you or other people, a lot of other people, do you want an extended warranty with that? I'm like, why? It changes so quickly. Why am I going to spend $200 on a $400 laptop when the, you know, technology changes so quickly?
Where did you get a $400?
Well, I'm just using that stupid example, but you know what I mean? Have you ever bought something from a store and they say, you know, a piece of technology, and there are $400 or $500 computers out there at Walmart, laptops.
I mean, the Chromebooks and stuff. Now, everything I have is Mac, and one thing I've been religious about doing is I get AppleCare on all my Macs.
Yeah.
But the reason being is, in fact, most of my Mac stuff, it lasts for a long time.
Yeah.
So for me, it's different than that because it's a higher investment for
the
Macs.
Exactly.
But to your point though, I think the other thing we're going to see too is here's my biggest concern, and coming from the era that I did, but I think when you start seeing how people view, the way communities work, the way society ought to work. I mean, I hate to say this, you know, with some of the college stuff, but, you know, some of the, quote, snowflakes that were out there that were triggered or were giving trigger warnings or people are easily offended. I'm just afraid is that we're going to have to – I don't want to mean the word dumb down in a bad way, but we're going to have to dumb down policing to match community standards because that's a lot of times what you do. I think we're going to reach this point to say, look, this far but no farther, guys. We cannot go below this and still be a law enforcement agency and still be there, you know, back up our partners when they need it. I mean, who's gonna run to the sound of gunfire?
Mm-hmm.
You really gets down to that point is, I mean, who's gonna run to the sound of gunfire? We still have to have people with that ethos, with that warrior ethos that says, you know, call me, I'll go. If that gunfire goes, I'll go into that building. I'll, mm-hmm. you know, if it's an active shooter, I'm the first one through the door. Nobody's gonna shoot my students, my kids.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm afraid that we will start losing that warrior ethos, just like the military is having tough times. So even the Army just announced that they are going to more liberal cities to recruit because they're having a tough time getting the number of recruits they need from their traditional sources.
Yeah. And to your point, Morgan, you saw that down in, you know, that horrible shooting down in Florida where the deputy, Hartman. And I don't know all the details behind that, where the deputy just sat outside.
Yeah, I don't need to know much. You can explain it all you want, but don't look at what they say, look at what they do. And mm-hmm. it's kind of like, go towards the sound of gunfire.
Exactly.
I mean, I hate to say it, man, but this is why you put on the badge, you got the vest, you got to let your training take over. But that's what I'm saying is it doesn't matter what age you are. If you don't have that ethos, you're not going to be able to do it. But if it starts becoming systemic
mm-hmm.
and it starts becoming inherent in all of the applicants, what's going to happen is you're going to get to a point. I'm not going to, you know, maybe it's 50 years into the future or something, but you're going to have something to where you've got places like Portland suggesting that the majority of police officers not carry firearms.
Oh, yeah.
It works, but it doesn't even work that many places in London. Because guess what? The homicide rate in London is actually higher than it is mm-hmm. New York City.
Yeah.
And all they have is knives.
Well, and we had a push. I think it was, I can't remember, somewhere out in California. Maybe you know. I don't know off the top of my head, Morgan, where there was a push to shoot to wound. And again, I mean, shoot them in the leg and shoot them in the arm or something like that. Yeah, that's feasible. But no.
Well, if you've seen the stories about many of the police shootings, you guys know that cops aren't that great a shot. You say shoot to wound. On some of these shootings, they're lucky that they hit the suspect at all,
yeah.
you know, but when you got the firefight going on. So this whole thing about what you think every police officer is a precision marksman that says I can shoot, you know, through a quarter at 50 paces.
Oh, yeah.
Well, now, when lead's getting thrown and you're ducking for cover and trying to find the only 6 inches of concrete that you can lay flat below.
Exactly.
You know, this shoot to wound crap. Yeah.
Well, Morgan Wright, I appreciate your time coming back on the show, sir. Always a pleasure. What's next for you? Any books or what's going on?
I'm still working on my fiction book. So it is I love reading David Baldacci and, you know, some other folks like that. I like the action stuff. So it's about a detective whose actual background is a clandestine intelligence officer for the CIA.
Oh.
And there's a whole story, but now he's got his CIA skills and now he's a detective. So I'm about halfway through that book, writing it. But from a business standpoint, I've got me and a couple buddies.
Yeah.
We were standing up another business focused on artificial intelligence. And I'll just give you a hint. I can't go into too much detail because obviously I don't want to give it away. But think of DNA for vehicles. So, you know, there's 7 billion people in the world, but there's also an awful lot of cars. But so we think there's a problem to be solved there. So just think DNA for vehicles.
It's amazing. I can't wait. Now, when you have your book, Morgan, I'd like you to come back on the show if you're up for it, sir.
Oh, absolutely. It's most thrillers, you know, most fiction novels are like, you know, 90 to 100,000 words. I'm halfway through and I've got 80,000 words. So I got a lot of editing to do.
Now,
just get the first draft done and then you can go from there.
Now, where can people find you, Morgan, if they want to reach out to you, sir?
Very simple, morganwright.us. Actually, I'm revising my page back to, you know, my professional page. So my work that I do, the speaking engagements that I do, the articles that I write, everything will be there. And then on Twitter at morganwright_US. And you can also find me on Facebook. A buddy of mine, Mac Pettigrew, he retired from the Ontario Provincial Police. We're just starting. We've done a couple of Facebook Lives. We're going to turn into podcasts, but we're going to do a podcast called Stupid Criminals Podcast.
Oh, I love it.
And trigger warning, if you're a stupid criminal, we're going to make fun of you. Now, we made a career out of doing this with a podcast called Copcast. Me and him and three of us, we did this podcast for about 120 episodes. So, but we just want to find the funniest, dumbest stories out there and make fun of stupid criminals.
Hey, that's what it's about. It keeps us in business, Morgan.
But that'll be coming out when it is. It's called stupidcriminalspodcast.com. It's not up yet, but I've got the domain registered, and so we'll be putting up a page for that. And that's kind of like catharsis. That's just a release. That's where we go just to have fun and talk about the old days, two old-timers, you know, reminiscing.
Well, thank you so much, sir, for your service as a Leo and your continued service to this great nation, sir. We wish you the most success in the future, sir. And, again, thank you for coming on the show.
Hoo-ah, go Army, beat Navy, and go Irish.
Hey, Army, 82nd, baby.
That's right, three in a row now. It's a three-peat.
All right, buddy. Take care, Morgan.
All right, thanks, Patrick.
All right, bye.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast. For more strategies for self-improvement and resources based on today's episode, be sure to head to cjevolution.com. You can also connect to Patrick directly on social media at @Pat_Fitzgibbons with any questions, comments, or concerns. We look forward to helping you find more personal success on the next episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast.